From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, the latest from the trial over Harvard's admissions practices and what that says about socioeconomic diversity on campus.
Replacing the white privileged kids of doctors and lawyers with black privileged kids of doctors and lawyers, that doesn't seem to me like adding very much diversity.
Also, how some Boston businesses are reacting to the death of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi. And a Rhode Island doctor argues that the cost of health care is affecting democracy and should spark a revolt.
Primary care is ridiculously affordable, so affordable that we could easily afford to give it away.
Plus, the situation in Puerto Rico 1 year after Hurricane Maria.
The fact that communities do not have proper infrastructure means that every time we have a rainfall, the community floods with wastewater.
That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. It is now week two of the trial involving admissions practices at Harvard University. And what we're learning from this trial involves more than just the case that's being heard. A lawsuit from the group Students for Fair Admissions claims that Harvard discriminates against Asian American applicants. And Harvard maintains that race is just one factor that it takes into account to create a diverse student body. And it denies that any discrimination is going on. But the 6 days of testimony in this trial have raised questions about Harvard admissions and college admissions in general, especially involving issues related to economic diversity and whether that should be considered in admissions as well. We want to spend some time today talking about these questions, this trial, and about defining diversity on campus. Listeners, we want to hear from you. Should economics be considered in college admissions, and how? How do you define diversity? You can call us at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also tweet us at Radio Boston. And first, we're going to go to WBUR Edify reporter Max Larkin, who has been following this Harvard trial. Welcome, Max.
Hi, Deb.
So tell us what happened today.
Well, you had top Harvard officials on the stand for the second day in a row, and they're being asked about the kind of efforts they've made to find a way to build the kind of diverse class they want without resorting to race, without considering race at all. The Supreme Court has asked that colleges like Harvard make a good faith effort to find so-called race-neutral approaches to fostering diversity. So lawyers for the group suing Harvard, Students for Fair Admissions, are grilling deans and other top officials about whether they really have done that.
And what does Harvard say?
They say we convened two separate commissions. Harvard convened two separate commissions that were designed to look into that question. They said at the end of that process of looking at it, they said they found no workable way to use race found no workable way to build a diverse and really academically excellent student body without recourse to race.
And now there's also been talk about socioeconomics and that kind of diversity in a student body. How's that been addressed in court, Max?
It started to come up in earnest yesterday, Deb, and I think it's a fascinating thing that's always been in the background here. So Harvard more and more has a racial breakdown that largely matches that of the country. But it's much more skewed when it comes to income, like most universities in this country, certainly most elite universities. So Harvard pulls about the same number of students from the richest 1% of American households, the richest 1%, as from the bottom 60% in terms of income. Some people say that's a staggering gap, and they say it's an argument that Harvard should basically ditch race as a consideration and start to focus on pulling from that disproportionately black, Latino, Asian tranche of American society and focus on, in a sense, recruiting poorer students. And you'd get a lot more diversity from that anyway. But I spoke to Anthony Jack, who teaches at Harvard, and he used to be one of the kids in this group. He was an African-American undergraduate at Amherst College from a poor background in Miami. He says you can't consider race and class separately.
To ignore race is to say that inequality does not exist in many ways, because social class is not the only thing that keeps students from applying or attending or excelling at institutions like Harvard and Yale and Princeton and Penn, or also our public state flagship like Michigan and Virginia and Berkeley.
So he says, don't ignore race. So what does Harvard say about this?
Yeah, Harvard says basically that there are, you know, there are two different kinds of disadvantage that they might encounter. They are always looking for students who come up against adversity, and that adversity could be discrimination on the basis of race or some of the obstacles that come up for people who are low income in their lives, barriers to entry into that elite part of society. I think SFFA, the group suing Harvard, is trying to show that Harvard, though it purports to really support diversity, it hasn't cultivated it in every sense. Mm-hmm. And you know, I wanted to play some tape here. We have Lawrence Bacow on this program, who said some time ago that students from the upper tiers of society, students whose parents went to Harvard, they tend to make better undergraduates because they have a sense of what it takes to go to the school.
As a group, the legacies are an extraordinarily accomplished group of applicants who, independent of the admissions process and how it selects them, have a leg up because they know and they understand the institution and they know and understand what it takes to thrive and succeed at the institution. So their applications tend to be, you know, well put together. They have deep knowledge of the institution. So it's a self-selected pool, which as a group, by almost any metric, looks very, very good relative to the broader applicant pool. Hmm.
Right. Almost people groomed to go to Harvard. But obviously, that's a controversial thing to say. I wonder, Max, part of Harvard's motivation for wanting to create a diverse student body is to reflect society at large. It is said, what do we know from this trial about its efforts to do that and whether it's been successful?
Well, like I said, the racial breakdown of the college largely reflects the racial breakdown of the country. In some categories, tellingly, when it comes to Asian Americans, there are many, many more Asian Americans, around 20% in the most recent incoming class at Harvard than there are in America at large. But I think the most kind of salient way in which it isn't reflecting the country is the relatively low percentage of students who come from low-income households, first-generation college families. Raj Chetty, an economist who actually works at Harvard, found that the median income of students there in the period he observed was around $150,000. That's quite high by American standards, and yet it's not even close to the highest median income among Massachusetts universities or among Ivy League colleges. And yet at the same time, you do have more and more poor students at Harvard. They've made an effort, and they say it's difficult to find yourself at this elite institution. I spoke today to Harvard sophomore Adelson Aguas-Vivas. He's from Newburgh, New York, family immigrated from the Dominican Republic, and he said he's had to do a lot of catching up as a poor student.
It definitely makes you feel like you stand out in a way when you first come here, because there are these kids that have all these resources that you don't necessarily have. You don't know how to navigate that. You don't know how to get an internship, join a club, write a decent paper.
But I'd say at the same time, Adelson said he had to seek out people who were like him, students from low-income communities, and they kind of banded together. And he is a staunch defender of the admissions policy as it was, which would have advantaged him as a student of color from a poor community.
Okay, I want to have some others join the conversation now. With us in studio, Raul Fernandez, program director and lecturer at the Boston University Wheelock College of Education and Human Development. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Pleasure to be here, Deborah.
Also on the line is Stephanie Niles, who's Vice President for Enrollment and Communications at Ohio Wesleyan University and President of the National Association for College Admissions Counseling. Welcome, Stephanie.
Thank you so much.
And also, listeners, don't forget, we do want to hear from you during this part of our show, rather, about this topic. How important is diversity in the college admissions process, and how do you define it? You can call us at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. And, Raul, I'm wondering, as you look at this Harvard trial and you hear what Max Larkin has just told us about the trial and what we're hearing regarding the admissions process, is this a big deal for admissions and for higher education in general? And what do you think it says about diversity or not diversity on college campuses?
Well, it certainly can be. I've been watching it very closely, as have our students.
And there's a few things that stand out to me, including from Max's reporting here. One is this idea that that Larry Bacow is saying that let's talk about legacy preference first of all, that that these students already have a leg up before they even apply. So to further tip, as Harvard is doing, to further tip legacies and give them even more preference, I think it's really interesting that we're looking at race as the factor here and not some of the other factors that are leading to some of the disparities that we find around income and around race as well. And that's something that needs to be addressed.
So when we saw some of those statistics and the statistics that Max mentioned, that wealthy students outnumber low-income students at Harvard 23-1. Yeah. Surprising statistic? Or, hey, didn't we know that wealthy kids primarily went to Harvard? What are you thinking?
I think we do know that. I it's one of those things that is shocking but not surprising. It's shocking to actually see that, see those numbers. But when we actually think about who's attending the most elite institutions in this country, that it's not at all shocking that there's that great wealth disparity. One of the things that's important as you ask the question, you know, what does this mean for higher education more broadly? Well, it could mean a lot if this ends up at the Supreme Court, but it's important to understand that admissions at Harvard is very different and at the elite institutions than most institutions around the country. And the fact is that most college students do not go to an elite institution. And so there's a very different experience there. With that said, whatever's decided in Massachusetts is likely to be appealed by whoever loses this case to the Supreme Court. And we could end up with a decision that much more broadly impacts the use of race as a factor in admissions throughout higher education.
Why is diversity important?
Well, the Supreme Court has said in the past that there is a compelling interest to institutions to have a diverse student body. The question is compelling to whom? So to the institutions themselves, to be able to bring people together from diverse backgrounds to learn from one another and then to have a sort of more educated, more thoughtful citizenry for sure. But there's been a real question on college campuses, and this is the issue of climate, as to whether or not diversity, bringing in students of color, is to the benefit of white students at that institution but not to the benefit of those students students of color. So every institution is touts whatever level of diversity they have. There's not one where you can look at their mission statement or website and say they're not diverse in some way, shape, or form. But certainly, one of the things that we heard Dean Fitzsimmons say during the trial this week is really about this legacy of racism in America, and that one of the things that Harvard at least is trying to do is to account for that in preferencing in particular black students in their admissions.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I want to bring Stephanie into the conversation. Stephanie Niles, can you tell me what you were thinking as the president of the National Association for College Admissions Counseling, as you hear what's happening in this trial?
Absolutely. I mean, both in that role as well as being a chief enrollment officer myself, I've had many of the same thoughts as Raul just reflected. I think that indeed, race is a factor that institutions are taking into consideration. We see our educational institutions are, by being more diverse, they are better able to educate a population of students who can think critically, who can consider different backgrounds, different perspectives, different ways of thought if they themselves are exposed to people whose backgrounds are different than their own. Mm-hmm. That's race, that's socioeconomic status, that's religion, that's a wide variety of factors that each individual brings to a college campus as they then share their thoughts and ideas in a classroom setting where they have that freedom to debate and discuss and rationalize and think differently about what they've grown up thinking or the background they've come from. They're better able to then take that broader perspective out into the community.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, do you, when you hear the statistics that we heard, for example, in the Boston Globe, that wealthy students outnumber low-income students at Harvard 23-1, what do you think about socioeconomic diversity and how to possibly change that? Or does it matter?
Yeah, I agree that it isn't surprising to hear that. I do think it's also important, as Raul said, to note that Harvard is one institution. The vast majority of students go to school at institutions that are not Harvard, and many of them reflect a much more diverse population of students, including socioeconomic status.
But I guess, I don't mean to interrupt, but I guess, and I'm going to ask Raul this too, I mean, if you're saying, well, that's the top school, so that's okay if it's the top school and that's primarily wealthy? I mean, isn't that further separating things?
I guess so. You also have to ask, is it indeed the top school, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, isn't the top school the place where each individual student will excel? A student who is best prepared to meet the challenges that they intend to encounter in the world, that's the best school for them. That may not be Harvard. That may be Harvard. It depends. I truly believe it depends on the individual student, and it isn't just about the school that is ranked the best, but the school where that student can thrive and excel.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I want to make sure we get some time in to take calls as well. Listeners, remember, we want to hear from you about this. Should diversity be considered in college admissions? How, and how do you define diversity? You can call us at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. David is calling from Lexington. David, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. I think diversity of income and class is more important than racial diversity, although I think that's somewhat important too. But we have in this country an expanding Gini quotient, which is, I think, one of the top two Gini quotients in the among Western industrialized nations, and it's getting worse. And politically, people are bending the rules so that the rich are getting ever richer, and I think having a bunch of lower class people at Harvard with a much better ratio than 1-23 so that the upper class people at Harvard can get to know them and hear their stories might help do something about this problem in the future, which mere racial diversity. I live in a racially diverse neighborhood where the average house is probably worth close to $1 million, and we're not that different from each other. It's nothing like the difference between me and someone who's grown up in a bad part of town with the family income of $20,000 or $30,000. And I just think that Harvard could do the country a great service by having a lot more diversity of class.
Okay. Well, thanks, David, very much for the call. Raul, I want to ask you, I wonder, Harvard has said that, it does admit wealthy students, and in part it does that because it helps it admit more low-income students, right? So who otherwise wouldn't be able to enroll, right? We're charging them full tuition here, and we're able to offer more assistance to lower-income students. Is that fair? And many schools have said that, right? They say that it helps us. So, if we admit wealthier students, mm-hmm. they're helping to subsidize the lower income students. Is that fair?
Well, it's certainly fair in the case of other institutions. But in the case of a Harvard or a Stanford or Yale or others with endowments that are $30 billion plus, Harvard could, if it wanted, offer free tuition to every student that attended there and still be able to have enough money to run its operations, and would likely be able to still bring in the kind of funding that they do through alumni relations and other forms. So for Harvard, if this was their argument, to say that we'd go broke if it wasn't for these high income students coming to our institution, I think that's just a fallacy. That might have been the case maybe a couple hundred years ago, but not today. I do want to mention one other thing. This pitting of whether or not we need to preference low income students or racial minorities, I think is unhelpful. If we're looking, and we have the data on this, but if we're looking at what is crowding out both racial minorities and low-income students, it is these other preferences. It is preference at Harvard, for instance, around legacy admissions, around students with athletic abilities, and many, many other things that we see coming out in the secret sauce in this trial. Mm-hmm. If you listen to Dean Fitzsimmons, who's being forced begrudgingly to tell the world how Harvard does its admissions, and we can see that what's crowding out students is not this preference for low-income students or for racial minorities. It's all these other things.
Hmm. So, Stephanie Niles, can you weigh in there in terms of legacy and athletics and those types of admissions criteria on colleges? I mean, do those need to change so we can have more diversity?
I think it also goes to the diversity of our classes. You know, again, diversity is so broadly defined. And so we're trying to put together diverse student bodies. We're trying to populate our athletic teams, our orchestras, our student governments. We're trying to bring in students who represent that broad variety of backgrounds in terms of their abilities and accomplishments, in terms of their perspectives, and in terms of how they'll contribute to our campus climate. So I would argue that those factors are part of the diversity that each institution is trying to build.
Mm-hmm. You know, we heard a cut from Ayla Shapiro on in our billboard to the show today, who was on Radio Boston earlier this month, senior fellow at the Cato Institute, and said, you know, replacing white privileged kids of doctors and lawyers with black privileged kids of doctors and lawyers doesn't seem like adding diversity. So I get the point, but how would you measure sort of socioeconomic diversity and use that as a criteria for admission, Stephanie?
I'm sorry, can you repeat the question again?
So how do you make sure that you're achieving socioeconomic diversity? What's your income standard? How do you know when you're achieving a more diverse student body?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, I think that, you know, I guess I'm not fully aware of there being a specific metric around that each institution would be held to. There's so many complicating factors that figure into how every institution puts together its class from a financial perspective. You know, it was stated earlier that, you know, Harvard is different. Harvard could indeed meet the need of every student who applies. That just isn't the case at the vast majority of institutions in this country. And so we do have to really look at what are the revenue needs that each institution must meet, and how can we generate them? And it varies greatly across institutions and institutional types.
Okay. Max Larkin, I'm wondering, what happens with the Harvard trial from here?
Well, we've got a lot more to go. It's a 3-week trial, and we can expect that we're going to hear not just the end of the plaintiff's case, but we'll be hearing, for instance, from amici, friends of the court. So students who've been affected by this policy and generally praise the policy are going to get a chance to testify. Then Harvard will present its case that what it's doing is not only compliant with the law, but beneficial, kind of necessary for its institutional priorities.
Okay. WBUR Edify reporter Max Larkin, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Deb.
Also, Raul Fernandez, program director and lecturer at the Higher Education Administration at the Boston University Wheelock College of Education and Human Development. Thank you.
Thanks, Steph.
Stephanie Niles, Vice President for Enrollment and Communications at Ohio Wesleyan and President of the National Association for College Admissions Counseling. Thanks to you as well.
Thank you very much.
And listeners, stay with us. Coming up, we talk with a Rhode Island doctor who says it's time for a healthcare revolution. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Saudi Arabia is holding a major investment conference today, minus a few big local names, including Boston-based Bain Capital. Still, some 3,000 people are expected to attend, despite the latest gruesome news about Saudi Arabia's involvement in the killing of journalist Jamal Khashoggi. Back in Boston, MIT says it's taking a closer look at the school's ties to Saudi Arabia. MIT hosted Saudi Arabia's Crown Prince back in March. Well, joining us to talk about this is John Chesto. He's business reporter for the Boston Globe, and he writes the column Chesto Means Business. Hi there, John.
Hi, how are you?
So let's start with MIT this week. Not surprising that MIT is going to weigh in here, right?
No, it's not at all. I mean, I think a number of schools and companies are taking a look at their ties to Saudi Arabia, their relationships in light of the news out of Turkey. And Jamal's death.
Mm-hmm. Do you think we'll see other universities, other businesses following suit here? And do you think it'll go, you know, deeper? Will folks actually sever ties, especially if they're lucrative?
I think we'll see some additional changes. But you know, this conference that's taking place this week was really sort of a a proxy for it, concerns, and it came at an inopportune time for Saudi Arabia so soon after the incident. And I think it drew a lot of the media's attention to the issue that, you know, it might not have gotten the same high level of coverage. So I think, you know, we'll see it play out over the next few weeks. And then, as is the case with often with these types of stories, that once it disappears from the headlines, maybe we won't see such internal scrutiny within the academic and corporate community as we're seeing now.
Now, as we mentioned, Bain Capital says not showing up to this so-called future investment initiative. But who from the Boston business community might go?
Well, we know, you know, there were four executives, prominent executives that were planning on going. As you mentioned, Bain's co-chairman, Steve Pagliuca, decided not to go after all of this happened. State Street's Ron O'Hanley also dropped out. But then we're still waiting on executives from GE and from Raytheon, who, as far as I can tell, are still going. You know, the companies have not confirmed or denied their plans. Saudi Arabia is a particularly important partner for Raytheon. Raytheon recently established a major operation there, and so I would be surprised if they don't send people.
So Raytheon had an earnings call this week, I'm told. And do you think this whole issue about Saudi Arabia is going to come up?
I don't know. It might. I mean, I think there's, you know, it's not an immaterial amount of revenue for Raytheon, but I mean, Raytheon has customers all over the world. This is, it's not like they're a major source of revenue, but it's still. Well, I've seen some figures, 1-4% in that range of Raytheon's revenue. So I think I would be surprised if someone doesn't ask on the call. So what's going on with Saudi Arabia?
Right. How about GE? What do we know about GE in Saudi Arabia?
GE is, they are trying hard. I can't speak specifically of Saudi Arabia, but I can say that they are trying hard to sell their turbine business and also their wind development business in the Middle East, and they've had a lot of success so far. Saudi Arabia is clearly a strong potential customer for them if they don't have contracts already, and so I could also see reasons why GE would still send people this week.
All right. John Chesto, business reporter for the Boston Globe, and he writes the column Chesto Means Business. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Our next guest says healthcare is on track to destroy our economy within 15 years, and it's time for what he calls a revolt. Dr. Michael Fine is a physician in Rhode Island and former director of that state's public health department. He's also author of the book Healthcare Revolt: How to Organize, Build a Healthcare System, and Resuscitate Democracy All at the Same Time. Dr. Fine, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you very much for having me.
That's a very ambitious title, but healthcare destroying not only our economy, you say in this book, but our nation. Can you explain?
Well, just from an economic perspective, in 2003, we spent about 17% of family income on healthcare. Now we spend about 30%. The projection is that by 2025, we're going to spend 50%. And somewhere between 2031 and 2038, we spend 100%. And I have no idea how that works economically. Right. But it's not only the economics that's concerning. It's the impact on our politics. There's about a trillion.
And you don't mean Obamacare, I take it.
I don't mean Obamacare. Okay. On our fundamental politics, there's about $1 trillion of unnecessary or wasted spending every single year out of our $3.2 or $3.3 trillion of spending. Of that unnecessary wasteful spending, essentially that's profit that's coming out for someone And going from the public pocketbook into someone's pocket.
So when you say wasteful spending, what do you mean by that? Do you mean that we're spending money on health care that's not going into health care? It's actually going into administrator salaries and other things? Or is that what you're talking about? Or redundancy?
It gets to administrative salaries, and it gets to profit, and it goes through different ways of keeping people busy, different jobs and different corporations, different organizations. And it comes in many different forms. One is the form of overuse, of providing services that just aren't necessary. One is the form of administrative cost itself, creating billing for or billing processes that don't produce any new information or any new effectiveness. There are a zillion of these little strains of income, but they end up really making it so that the United States has health care that costs twice as much as the average of the other industrialized countries in the world.
So essentially, are you saying, when you said strains of income, my ears sort of perked up. I'm wondering, are you saying that all of these people saw a way to sort of cash in on health care and kind of dug in to get their piece of the pie, and so that's what we're dealing with right now, is this over-bloated financial system that's supporting a lot of people but isn't really delivering what it's supposed to be?
That's exactly right. You know, you can think it ranges from hospital executive salaries that are millions of dollars a year in organizations that are often supposed to be nonprofits, to folks who apply for and get one of those nifty little wheelchairs, electronic wheelchairs, many of which are very important and valuable to their lives. But the process that convinces them to get it is a for-profit process. And everybody along the line has a piece of profit in supplying those goods and services to people who may or may not need them. Many times people need them, but often some of these services are not, in fact, needed at the end of the day.
Mm-hmm. And I know your book mentions solutions, but untangling this, I think, is going to be a big mess. First, let's talk about who we can blame. Is it doctors? Is it insurers? Is it big pharma? I mean, those are your usual suspects here. All of the above?
Well, I think it's been called a medical industrialized complex, and that's really what it is. Everybody has a piece of this. Everybody's got golden handcuffs and
right.
has trouble changing it. We're all used to a certain level of income and have certain income expectations and a certain level of profit and a certain level of profit expectations, and those inflate over time. If I was going to blame, you know, I'm not big on blaming, but if I was going to blame one sector, the sector is essentially government, because we've allowed this to happen. This is often a public process. Most people don't realize that 65% of what we spend on health care is public money from Medicare and Medicaid and Veterans Administration and so forth. Yet it has no functional oversight. The process itself kind of becomes ongoing because we've relied on the market to distribute services instead of going through the process of organizing and distributing services directly.
So what do we do? I know you have experience working in Scituate as a physician, and you created the Central Falls Neighborhood Health Station, right? That's described as this attempt to build population-based primary care and a public health collaboration. Is that what you're talking about, that we might need to prevent this revolt?
Well, I think that's one of the near things that we're going to need to do in order to build a healthcare system instead of a market. You know, the neighborhood health station we're opening in Central Falls is one single clinical enterprise that has primary care and behavioral health and urgent care and emergency medical services and lab and x-ray and substance use treatment all in one place, one team of people responsible for the care of the entire population of the city of Central Falls, or about 20,000 people. That's what it looks like, you know, sort of city by city and place by place. But I think what we really need to do is start the revolt. The only way to get this done, given the weight of money that's transferred to the other side, the weight of resistance to any small change, the only way to get this done is to build a movement that is going to have to look something like the civil rights movement or the abolitionist movement or the movement for marriage equality. You know, we have in this nation been able to fundamentally change our society a number of times, but we have to work on it. And it doesn't happen overnight. And it doesn't happen just by writing a law. It happens by, you know, a general mobilization of thousands or hundreds of thousands of people all working together. Hmm. The resistance is so huge.
Well, I'm kind of cynical.
Well, I think all of us have gotten cynical, and all of us have gotten to accept it. Of the $1 trillion, the people who have something to sell spend 0.05% of that money on lobbying. That's $500 million a year on lobbying. Hmm. That kind of spending has totally distorted the political process and has made things so that our legislators often pay much more attention to people with something to sell than they do to the people they represent. And the only way to get that back is to build a mobilization.
You say doctors should do this, and they should unionize, and they should strike.
Well, doctors, nurses,
healthcare
physical
workers.
Therapists, mm-hmm. healthcare workers in general. Mm-hmm. We have, as a model, living in Chestnut Hill, Dr. Bernard Lown, who won the Nobel Peace Prize in 1985. He's a model and a teacher and a mentor, and actually wrote the introduction to the book. But Dr. Lown is a world-famous cardiologist, who in the late 60s and 70s began to realize that all the cardiology that he could ever do would be useless if there was a nuclear war. So he began to work with colleagues around the nation and around the world. He met a colleague who was similarly renowned in the then Soviet Union, Dr. Yevgeny Chasnov, and together they organized something called the International Physicians to Prevent Nuclear War. That group of people did lots of organizing both inside the healthcare community and outside of it, and actually forced nuclear disarmament, and that's what got them the Nobel Peace Prize. That's the example that I think all of us need to follow.
What do you say to the folks who say, you know, yep, it's expensive, and that's why it's the best in the world? Costs money.
It's not the best in the world. When we look at it, we rank somewhere between 41st and 57th in the world for public health outcomes, depending on which outcome we're looking at and which year it is. We are not even close to the best outcomes in the world. So our infant mortality rate is 3 times the best achievable rates in the world for the average American and 9 times the best achievable outcomes for African Americans. That is not the best in the world.
Some would say, though, that there are people from other countries who would flock here to take the health care that we have. I'm channeling my father-in-law here. You know, I know exactly what he would say. So he would say, well, you know, our hospitals are top-notch. And if you look at the Mass Generals of the world, where some people have floors dedicated to them to, you know, to be able to get health care here, what do you say?
A few people come here for very sophisticated health care. But most people in most parts of the world understand that their basic health care is way better than ours is. In most countries that do this with any level of sophistication or success, everybody has access to primary care, similar to the model we're building in Central Falls. That primary care is available to them, and that's where they start. And they make sure that every single person in the society has that kind of access. Huh. Here in the United States, only about 50% of us haven't used primary care in a regular way.
All right. Well, some provocative ideas. I wish we had more time to flush them out, but I'm sure we'll have you back. Dr. Michael Fine, practicing physician in Rhode Island and author of the book Healthcare Revolt, How to Organize, Build a Healthcare System, and Resuscitate Democracy All at the Same Time. Dr. Fine, thanks for coming in.
Thanks very much for having me.
Coming up, a year after Hurricane Maria hit Puerto Rico, we check in with WBUR's Simone Rios, who visited the island right after the storm and 1 year later. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Massachusetts is home to more than 300,000 people from Puerto Rico, and most have been affected in some way by Hurricane Maria. The storm disrupted power and communications across the island and resulted in about 3,000 deaths. Joining us to talk about this is WBUR's Simone Rios, who was in Puerto Rico just after Hurricane Maria and recently returned for a look at how things are now, 1 year later. Hi, Simone.
Good afternoon, Deb.
So what stands out from your return trip to Puerto Rico?
So really, this island is facing a mountain of problems. It's come a long way since the storm hit a year ago. But the major underlying issues, I mean, Puerto Rico's crumbling infrastructure, the economic crisis that the island is facing. One of the things I should say that I really hadn't put a lot of thought into, Deb, is this idea that Puerto Rico is a colony of the United States. A lot of people feel that way, you know, and where we were staying in the Santurce section of San Juan, it was almost like nothing had ever happened. But when we headed to smaller towns and into the mountainous region of Puerto Rico, you know, it's really another world.
Hmm. So tell me first, before we get to that contrast, what are officials there saying? I understand you met with the mayor of San Juan.
Yeah, we met with Carmen Yulín Cruz, the mayor of Puerto Rico's biggest city, the day after the hurricane. And she's the one, she's a BU grad, as you might remember, and she really made a name for herself in her very public confrontations with President Trump over the administration's response to Hurricane Maria. Like many others, she says the island is getting second-class treatment when compared to states that have also experienced disasters. To illustrate this point, she told a story about the head of the Puerto Rican Energy Authority.
The director of PREPA at the time told the Puerto Rican people that he was told that Puerto Rico could not purchase any generators and electric poles from countries outside of the U.S., but the U.S. didn't have any poles left because of the emergencies that had happened. As a colony of the United States, we are literally a hostage market.
I mean, it's interesting because Yulín has really become something of a national or even international figure, but she's also a municipal leader. So she really sees firsthand the sort of codependent economic relationship that Puerto Rico has with the federal government. But I should say that she cautions people not to assume that what you see in San Juan, the way they've recovered from the hurricane, is representative of the entirety of Puerto Rico. Mm.
And so outside of San Juan, then, what is it like, Simón?
Yeah, Deb, let me just say that in San Juan, you have multiple worlds, it feels like. We were staying in the Santurce area. Again, it's like, you know, nothing really happened. And then you go a couple miles away into some of the more interior neighborhoods, and it's like ghost towns, you know, and entire streets of ruined houses, feral cats roaming the streets, mosquitoes, stagnant water. And you can feel the absence of people, you know, like neighborhoods with no kids out playing. You can just really feel it. And some of the most marginalized neighborhoods say that to this day, a year later, they still haven't received any help from the government or even from community organizations. These kind of organizations have done a lot of work to make up for the shortcomings of the government. And one of the people we interviewed was Livia Rodriguez. She heads an organization called Proyecto Enlace del Caño Martín Peña, something of a mouthful. But it's a community group that operates along a canal in some of San Juan's poorest and most dense neighborhoods. She told us this area is where socioeconomic issues intersect with environmental issues.
The fact that communities do not have proper infrastructure means that every time we have a rainfall, the community floods with wastewater. And that is having terrible effects on public health. And this has been proven for the longest time. We're losing the estuary, the San Juan Bay estuary, where the main airport and ports are located. The airport has been flooding with major storms because of the situation of Caño Martín Peña.
So you can see the magnitude of this. You know, again, this is just one neighborhood. And Rodriguez told us that in order to make this neighborhood resilient, it's going to require an $800 million investment. And apparently that money was lined up through a congressional appropriation for reconstruction in Puerto Rico. And the Puerto Rican government had designated this project among its top priorities. And at the last minute, policymakers in Washington decided not to fund the work and to fund other projects instead.
Simón, you also revisited the town of Punta Santiago. What was that like?
This was one of the hardest hit areas of Puerto Rico. It's where Maria made landfall on the 20th of September in 2017. It was just shattered by the hurricane. One thing that stuck with me was this image that Jesse Costa, our photographer who came with me to Puerto Rico, had taken. And it was a middle-aged woman hunched over a bucket of water, cleaning what remained of her worldly possessions, some silverware, a purse she had. That image just really stuck with me, and I wanted to go back and see if we could find her. Her name was Angelina Arroyo Rivera, and this is what she said.
¿Cómo está Angelina?
Regular las cosas.
¿Y su esposo?
Él falleció.
Él falleció. Sí.
So I asked her there how she was doing, and she sort of said, you know, más o menos, regular. And then I asked her about her husband, who had been in the hospital, she told us when we were there the first time. She hadn't seen him for a few weeks, and he apparently had passed away. She thinks as a result of the hurricane, the effect that it had just from a stress standpoint, and also because of the, you know, the difficulties it caused for healthcare infrastructure on the island.
And how is she doing now?
Life is tough. It, you know, it really is. But, you know, she had the opportunity to stay with family. She has a daughter in Connecticut. But she says she doesn't like the lifestyle in the States. She'd prefer to deal with the situation in Puerto Rico, even if that means her only company are the plants that she waters on her patio.
Mm. What about things in the rest of the town, Simón?
So a stone's throw from Arroyo's home is the town dock of Punta Santiago. A year earlier, community leader Pedro Morales Oquendo had made a point of showing us how the dock's planks had been lifted up by the floodwaters and strewn across the town. The dock was central to Punta Santiago's beach culture, and the local fishermen used it to head out to sea. A year later, we wanted to see if it had been fixed, but it had not been. Here's Morales.
Se habla de que la recuperación en Puerto Rico va a tardar cerca de 7 to 10 años, la recuperación total. Pero nosotros no
He's saying
esperar.
It's estimated the recovery will take 7 to 10 years, but that people can't wait that long. And that's why nonprofits like his are doing what they can to rebuild the town. That includes getting grant money to rebuild the dock, as well as about 100 homes still ruined a year after the storm.
It's my understanding, Simone, that many people on the island who believe they're entitled to recovery money have not received it.
Yeah, and this was evident everywhere we went. In August, a group of Senate Democrats said FEMA had rejected 61% of the more than 1 million applications for relief. More than 43,000 appeals came in, and FEMA apparently denied 79% of the appeals. Again, this is something that came up wherever we went, that this was a challenge that communities across Puerto Rico are facing. Mm-hmm. And it's just one indicator of how vast this island's challenges are.
Hmm. So will Puerto Rico get recovery money, and any word on when or what might happen when it does?
Yeah, it's already starting to roll in, and Puerto Rico is set to receive literally tens of billions of dollars in recovery money. It sounds great, but in reality, it depends where that money is spent. There's a lot of fears among people in Puerto Rico. Even the mayor of San Juan talked to me about this, that the money won't be spent in the most productive way. But there's also a lot of hope that it's done in a way that re-energizes this economy, that it serves as a stimulus to an economy that, again, is in the midst of a recession.
But would you say, Simone, though, that the people there seem to be committed to continue to fight?
They are. I mean, I want to go back to this question of the economy. You know, Puerto Rico was already in the midst of a decade-long recession that some economists refer to as a Great Depression. Then came the hurricane, you know. And at the end of the day, what interests me the most about this whole conversation is that it's caused people on this island to reflect on what it means to be tied to the United States, and whether they'd be better off as the 51st state or as an independent country. But, you know, I want to say that the Puerto Rico we encountered was an incredibly vibrant, welcoming place. The people are incredibly proud. And, you know, the hurricane seems to have strengthened this feeling. I met Jose Cruz in the town of Toa Baja, not far from San Juan. The locals there said a majority of the town had left after the storm. But Cruz says he'll never leave.
El capitán. que abandone su nave es un responsable. Primero son.
He says the captain goes down with the ship, and he says he'll never abandon Puerto Rico.
I'm WBUR reporter Simone Rios. Simone, thanks so much for being with us.
Hey, thanks for having me, Deb.
And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Our show is produced by Jamie Bologna, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, and Zoe Mitchell. We had help today from Eve Zukoff. Tim Skog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Deborah Becker. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.